Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. This is a recording of meaningful discussions based on the 13 Petaled Rose with Rabbi Chaim Sperlin.
Good evening and welcome to lesson three. Three in Jewish law is a chazakah, is an establishment. So we're very excited that we made it to number three. Lesson one, we started with Rabbi Steinsaltz. Lesson two, we started with Freud and the Fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe. Today, I'd like to start with something a little bit unusual. We all experienced and saw the incredible miracle that happened this week in Israel, or miracles, about 350 of them, that happened in the course of a couple of hours. The videos and the information that's still coming out is really, really something. And it's these types of moments where we all know that on October 7th, we were unfortunately caught with our pants down. And it feels like this week we were caught with ourselves up and, you know, up and ready and tight. And there's no question about it that God had a very strong arm protecting us this week. And for this, we make a special blessing, because everything has a blessing. So the blessing that we make, and you can repeat after me, is Baruch HaTov VeHameitiv. Blessed is the one who is good and who does good. And with every blessing, along with that, we have also a request. Because now we see what God is capable of. And our request to the Almighty is that He can show us and the world miracles. May He continue showing miracles. May the hostages come home. May we experience and live with long-lasting peace. May some of our newfound friends who maybe have not yet announced that they're really friends of ours be protected as well. May they be prosperous. May they continue protecting us. May we continue protecting them. It's a whole new Middle East. And the greatest prayer that we all ask always is Oseh Shalom Bimramav, the one who makes peace up on high. Yaseh Shalom Aleinu. May He bring lasting peace to us, all of the Jews, and of course, all of those who look out for us. Amen. Lesson one made us astronomers. Lesson two made us psychotherapists or psychoanalysts. Lesson three will make us physicists. We are going to enter the land of spiritual physics. To start, we will open with a quick question to keep in mind. Is bacon holy? Is time holy? Is space holy? Are people holy? Are animals holy? What is holy? On page 51 in our lovely book, The 13 Petaled Rose, he opens up the chapter four, with the following quote. The root meaning of the concept of the holy in the holy language, which is Hebrew, is separation. It implies the apartness and remoteness of something. The holy is that which is out of bounds, untouchable, and altogether beyond grasp. It cannot be understood or even defined, being so totally unlike anything else. To be holy, in essence, to be distinctly other. There is much in the world that may be great, good, noble, or beautiful without necessarily comprising any part of the essence of the holy. For the holy is beyond qualification. What comes out over here is that the word holy in Hebrew, kadosh, means separate, which begs an obvious question. What is so scary of physics or of this earth that holy wants to be separate from it? What is so scary of us that holiness is running away, that holiness has to be separate from us? Because if it's separate, that means that it's separate from us, I assume, unless it's separate from something else. But the way he's translating holy is the word separate. Separate means that there is something that it's trying to be apart from. Holiness and us and the world is not usually aligned. It's separate. So the question is, why? What is so bad here? Is this so terrible? I'm loving it here. I hope all of you are loving it here too. Why is holiness running away? Why is holiness trying to be exclusive and separate? What does it find unlovely here that it's running away from? Or where is it pulling us when we try to become holy or want to be holy, that we have to leave from where we are? It's great where we are. Why can't holiness just be here? So we really need to understand this definition. The definition, where does he get the definition from? This is open-ended. The definition doesn't have a source. So where does the definition separate come from? I'll give you a small source for this. What do we say under the chuppah when somebody betroths a spouse? What is the word that is used? Mikudash, hareat mikudeshet li. And then the husband, traditionally, sometimes there's a response. The husband will say, hareat mikudeshet li, you are betrothed to me, which is an incorrect translation, right? Betrothed means in English, a word of marriage. Mikudeshet means you are now holy to me. And the two witnesses that are there respond, mikudeshet, mikudeshet. She is now holy, right? Now what happened here? Before she wasn't holy, and now there's a Tosafot. Tosafot is the extras, the side column on the Talmud that explains this puzzling term that the Talmud uses for marriage. Kiddushin is the tractate of marriage. There is another tractate called Ketubot, which is the tractate of marriage documents, but the tractate for marriage is Kiddushin, holiness. What's the idea? So this commentary writes that from now on, the couple are removed. That term, muvdal, removed from everybody else. They are a couple to each other. And because they're removed from everybody else, it's the same thing as holiness, because holiness is removed from everywhere else. So that's one of the sources where he gets this from. It's the name of a tractate in Talmud, Kiddushin. It's what we say every day under the chuppah. So it's obvious, if you know as much as he knew, being a commentary on the Talmud. So to him, it's obvious, but to us, it needs a little bit of explanation. It needs a footnote. Why is Kadosh the same as separate? So now that we got past the translation, we still need to understand what is it that holiness is running away from? What is wrong with whatever exists as it is that holiness is running away from? To explain this, we're going to need two introductions. Two solid introductions. Both of them are fundamental Kabbalistic ideas. Both of them have tens of thousands of words spilled upon them across many, many books. We will do what we can to summarize these two introductions, and hopefully we emerge with at least the general idea of them. Both of them are much broader and have a much wider range, but hopefully we'll do something for it. So far, so good? Okay. Here is a verse from Tehillim. It comes from Tehillim chapter 119, Kuf Yotet, verse 89. Le'olam Hashem, forever God, Devarcha Nitzav Bashamayim. This is an interpretation translation, as you see. The Lord exists forever, Le'olam Hashem, forever God, okay, however you want to translate that. Your word stands firm in heaven. Devarcha Nitzav Bashamayim, your word stands firm in heaven. What does this mean? A cryptic statement from King David. God Almighty, you are forever, and your word stands firm in heaven. Any insight? God's word. God's word. Isn't that like God? In the heaven and not in the earth? Is it also in the earth? Yeah. It's a cryptic statement to say. And why his word? Is it just his word is in heaven? Right. Isn't everything? Isn't God everywhere? Is just his word there? What's going on with this verse? This is a verse from King David, Tehillim. It's a verse that's common. This is not hiding anywhere. Yes? You earn the pass at the Seder table to be the wise son. Very good. What other words do we know in the Torah? the 10 words that God used to create the world. The 10 utterances, 10 words that he used to create the world. Those 10 words, one of them is that there should be a heaven. That word, your word, one word, there are 9 others that are not being addressed in this verse. That one word stands firm in heaven. Why is it standing firm in heaven? There's a reason for this. And this little verse, this little line pops out a entire theory. The theory goes like this, something like this. God creates the world with words. But who do we see? Anybody know who he is? I don't know. We see a pitcher who's about to throw, I don't know, 70 miles an hour on that? More? 90? They go 90 these days? You see how much I know about baseball. 90 miles an hour. Is a pitcher also a good boxer? Not necessarily. There's a talent and a muscle that a pitcher develops over a long course of time, sometimes from a very young age, and they learn speed of the arm. They master the art of a strong pitch. What happens as soon as the ball leaves the pitcher's hand? The ball starts flying at 90 miles an hour. Or more or less, whatever it is, until it dies. And then the ball falls down on the ground. Let's say nobody catches it. It falls down on the ground. Will anybody say that the day will come that, look, the ball knew how to fly just a few minutes ago? Give it a few minutes and the ball is going to learn how to fly again. Nobody will say that. Why? Because we know that balls, with the rules of gravity, fall back down towards the earth. Now, they could go against their nature. If somebody who has a strong arm is able to invest all that energy, the energy of their arm, the energy of the food they ate that day, the energy of the lessons that they took in order to put a good pitch, the energy of their coach, so much goes into that pitch and so much is invested in that flying ball. And the more they invest, the further that ball will fly. But eventually the ball will stop flying. That ball never, even while it was flying, never earned its own wings. It was always 100% codependent on the energy of the person throwing the ball. This is a very general example that's given in Hasidic and Kabbalistic texts about the way God created the world. God created the world. The world, by nature, doesn't exist. It shouldn't exist. There's no force that is making the world exist as if to say that it's against the rules for the world to be. Existence is something new, just as a ball flying is something new. So existence is new, it shouldn't exist. So the fact that it's in existence is because somebody is making it exist the whole time. There's energy there on the back end that is keeping it alive. Let's go back to our verse. Your word stands firm in the heaven. That's the word of the heaven that's keeping the heaven together. The word is there keeping the heaven together. As soon as the word stops, the heaven will stop. A small difference, little parentheses that we believe to be a difference between the pitcher and God, is that the pitcher, once they send the ball out, they can't call the ball back in. Whereas God's words, he could always pull the words back. Leave that as a parenthesis. It's an important piece, but that's related to other subjects, not so much tonight's subject. So God's word stands firm in the heaven. As long as it's there, the heaven is there, the word goes away, the heaven goes away. What would that say, just this information, what would that say about bacon? What would that say about things that typically in Judaism we do not welcome on regular days? I don't know. What does it say about them? What does it say about everything in the universe? It's all part of the baseball. If it's there, there must be godly energy in there making it be here. If it didn't have that godly energy there, it would not be here. So just as there's a word in heaven keeping it together, there's a word in everything keeping it together. This is introduction number one. Introduction number one, the conclusion that we would have is that there's God is everywhere. Like the kids say in their song, God is here, God is there, God is everywhere. And there's a reason why God is everywhere. God is everywhere because nothing would be able to exist if it wasn't anywhere. Now, again, a quick parenthesis, you could say that it's not God, it's God's words that are everywhere. We will leave it, we will leave the question as a good question, not to leave it undone. There is another thesis that explains that God's word is one with God, different than us, that our words are separated from us. So there's a couple of important little parentheses. There's a lot going on here in the undercurrents, but we're trying to hold it together. I asked if I should go light or heavy, so we're going somewhere right in between. Based on what we have so far, everything that exists has a living God inside it. So far, so good. Let's go to introduction number two. Yes. Great question. You're asking that based on introduction number one, God is everywhere, and that's the exact opposite of the way we translated the word holiness. We translated holiness as separation. This would indicate that holiness and physics are intertwined as one. And that's an amazing question. That's a really good question. Then our translation of holiness, why is it running away? It should be very comfortable right here. Why is it separated? It shouldn't be separated at all. That's a good question. And that's where introduction number two is going to give us the polar opposite of what introduction number one told us. So introduction number one tells us that it's all one and physics and holiness are one. Introduction number two is going to do a spin on that. So I guess we're ready for introduction number two. Here we go. What's that? Yes. And I hope that that duality will come to life now. That's what it's all about. Here's another verse from Shmuel 1, chapter 2, verse 2, in the beginning of Shmuel. Shmuel was a prophet born to Hannah. Yes? We read about him on the first or second day of Rosh Hashanah. An incredible story. His mom didn't have children, prayed to God for a child, ends up having Shmuel, who becomes a prophet and one of the first prophets. A lot of beautiful things that Shmuel said. Here is one of them. There is no holy one like God, like the Lord. All right, that's very nice. Nothing new, though. There is no holy one. Notice the words. There's no holy one, which means that there's nothing as removed as God, if we translate holy as removed. Truly, there is none beside you. There is no rock like our God. Ein sur kelokenu. There is no rock like our God. Now, in the texts of the Torah and the five books of Moshe, we believe that the texts should have literal translations and interpretations and homiletics. And they're open to all of that. In the books of the prophets, which there's 24 books of them, we are much more fluid and flexible on the translations. The translations, we don't take always as literal as we would in the five books of Moshe. To support that, we have a early commentary, Rabbeinu Bachya, Ibn Pekuda, who explains what does it mean that there's no rock like our God. So the word rock has been used a lot. We say it every day in our davening. The word rock and connecting God to being our rock has become an American slang. She is my rock. He is my rock. It's like a word of support. It's a word of strength. I assume that it's a biblical slang, as we have many of them. Raining cats and dogs, by the way, comes from the Bible too. That's for another time. So there's a lot of slang that has been adapted from Hebrew texts, and it's possible that this is one of them. But Rabbeinu Bachya didn't know English, and he didn't know American slangs, or at least I don't know that. Maybe he did. He argues that Ein Sur Kelokenu has a completely different meaning. Ein Sur Kelokenu is not that there is no rock like our God, or maybe not that it's not that, but in addition to that, it has another translation, Ein Sayar Kelokenu. There are words that the Talmud plays with, that if it's a word that sounds similar to a different word, it will say, don't read it like this word, read it like that word. There is no rock like God. He says there is no artist like God. And he closes his commentary right there. There is no artist like God. All right. A good arborist or environmentalist or zoologist would translate that there is no artist like God. Just go to the zoo and you will see that God is incredible. There's some amazing art that he's made, right? There is so much in this world that is really, really beautiful. Trees, the colors, his choice of colors, everything matches. You ever saw something in nature that doesn't match? doesn't exist. Everything somehow, when it's in nature, it matches. If I would wear that as my shirt and that as my pants, my wife will let me in for dinner. But somehow in nature, the colors just all come together. There is no artist like God. That is a superficial translation of there is no artist like God, although a very good translation. There's another translation that there is no artist like God. And that is, it's going to take a little time to unravel. So bear with me, but the translation is going to be there is no deceiver like God, because that's what an artist is. An artist is a deceiver. An artist is someone who makes a painting and portrays something that looks like it's alive and it isn't. It looks like it's three-dimensional and it's not, it's flat. The artist is, the greater the artist, the greater the deception. There are some artists, modern art, that is not so much in the deception category. The earlier forms of art that they would make a portrait that would look like a real picture, that is kind of what we're talking about. We're talking about the artist that is able to fool us to believe that something that they painted is an actual camera shot of something real. The artist is a deceiver. Now, we're going to see soon that deceiver, you know, in English, deception is a very negative word. I hope that during this introduction, we'll see we're not talking a negative deception at all, but it is a deception nonetheless. You had a question? Great. That's a good interpretation as well. Just the creator is an artist, because artists are creative. The top of the line of creatives are artists, and that's an easy translation too. Great. I like that. That would match the base translation of there is no artist like God. And here we're taking that a step further, which the Kabbalists do, that they interpret this rabbi to say that what he meant is not that there's no artist, that he meant to say that there is no deceiver. But we have to see what this means, because it sounds, you know, it sounds negative. But here's the first art of deception. Looks gorgeous, doesn't it? This is a colorful frog that we have here. The blues, the oranges, the different, there's a few different shades of blue, a few different shades of orange. This is one of the most venomous frogs that you don't need to be bitten by to die from. Touching its skin alone will kill a human. Might take a couple days. Look how cute that is. You want to touch it. You want to see what it feels like. This is a deception. It's poisonous. Huh? Very good. I forgot the name. I appreciate that. The poison dart frog. Thank you. Our in-house zoologist. And here's another one, just because I thought he was cute while he's croaking. What do they call it? That's also, you see these incredible colors. And then, real or fake? This snake was made by AI. Which is annoying, because I thought that was really cool. But the colors don't match, so God didn't make that one. This is deception in nature, where you have, I like the originals better, where you have a creature that presents itself as very welcoming, but you get too close and it's very dangerous. Some of the prettiest colors, not all, but some of the prettiest colors in nature are dangerous. Why would God do that? Now, I'll tell you that there's a rabbi who said any God, the Kutzker Rebbe, said any God that we could understand, I would never serve, which is a good line. Any God that we can understand, I would never serve, because that's a God that is like me. So we won't have answers to some of these questions of why. We could, though, talk about the what. The what is that God created these deceiving looking things in nature, whether in frogs or in some fruits that are very pretty and very dangerous. Some fruits that are dangerous are ugly looking. There's this black apple that I saw in Florida in the where the gators are. What is that black apple? It's deadly, and it's a really ugly looking black, like a purple, deep purple black apple. You see that and you're like, all right, you know, that lines up with where is it from, the black apple? That's Cinderella. I don't know, one of these kid films where they eat the apple. Anyway, Snow White, there we go. Thank you. Yes. Yes. Okay, great. I like that. What you're saying is that magic we get a lot of pleasure from, and that's a form of deception. which is true, and I can appreciate that. And God wants that frog to be protected, but the brown toad, he has enough of that one you can crush. Okay. So that might be a protector to humans. We have a lot of ideas around this table, which is incredible. That one is saying that it's God made it as a protector for the frog, and one saying is that it's a protector for the humans. Either way, I think that they can both be true. You know, it's a protector to both. We still don't know why this one, not that one. It's great. That's also true. It's for itself. It's for its own preservation. Yes. Okay. Look at that. And there's probably more ideas. That's a nature version of God's deception. Once we're talking about deception, fake or real, it's not clear here, but on the computer it was clear. Look at that. People have an amazing talent. Is that ball really floating? It's a paper. It's unbelievable. Look at that one. And then finally, we said we would go light. Mona Lisa got some legs. All right. Intro number one, everything in existence is infused with some type of godly spark that continues to bring it into existence, meaning there's holiness in it. Intro number two, God is the greatest artist and master of deception. In intro number two, when we talk about deception spiritually, we understand now where there's deception in some of the biology and in some of the creatures of the world, in the botanical world. The deception that God creates in the universe spiritually is your question. If God is everywhere, why don't we see it? If God's word is holding the heavens together, that means that God's word is holding the earth together. God's word is holding us together. Why don't we see it? Why don't we feel it? Once in a while, maybe we feel it. Once in double whiles, maybe we'll see it. Very, very rare. I do believe that we saw it this week in what I would call biblical level miracles with what happened in Israel. I do believe so. But they're rare. We didn't see it 6 months ago. Why is it so hard to come across this godly spark inside the universe? That is God's deception. So number one is the truth. Intro number one is the truth. The truth is that there is a spark of God in everything that exists. Intro number two tells us, but there's a catch. And the catch is that he hid it and deceived us from being able to see it. That is the artist that they say this rabbi talked about, that God is a deceiver, that he doesn't let us see the godly spark inside everything. That's the deception that God created. With these two introductions, we now understand why holy is removed. Yes? Are we getting it? Holy is removed, not essentially, but it's removed to the observer. The observer cannot see holiness. And holiness will not reveal itself in the world of physics. Part of the art, let's call it, of the world is that the spirit will be concealed and that holy will be removed, not by choice, so to speak, of ours, but by design, by divine design, that holiness will be removed by definition. What's the difference? You're saying that there's a difference between removing it and masking it. You're right, but what is the difference? That's the difference. The tree falling in the forest and nobody hearing it. So the difference is it really removed or is it just removed to the observer? And the answer is no, it's not really removed. It's not really removed. Holiness is everywhere, but our eyes have been blackened from being able to see it. We're wearing sunglasses. We don't have the eyesight. We have a vision that sees physics. We don't have the vision that could see, just like we can't see the radio waves that are dancing here or any other waves for that matter. Our eye cannot see things that are too small or not within the parameters of physics. So we just can't see it. You're right. That doesn't mean that it's not here, but it's removed to us. This is the translation of saying that holiness is removed is very much a translation that is us-based. To us, it's removed. We can't see it. And it's part of the deception that it's not going to be available for us to see. But the point is very good. And that's another parenthesis, that to God, there is no deception. God sees the world from his perspective. He sees his spark everywhere, which, yes, to see that stuff, I did. And we're going to talk about, we're going to hit on that. These two intros are in order to bring us to the crux of chapter 4. And that's what we're going to go to right now. Did anybody have a chance to take a quick read of chapter 4? A quick glance? Yeah? Not really? Okay. The deception gets 3 degrees of deception. The 3 degrees of deception means that something will be removed from expressing its godly spark in 3 degrees. One will be extremely removed, one will be lightly removed, and one will be zero to non-removed. When you go to the eye doctor, I've been going to the eye doctor since first grade. When we go to the eye doctor, they ask us, do you see it better now? Do you see it better now or do you see it better now? And you say, oh, show me number 2 again. Right? We go back and forth. Oh, I see it better now. Or there's no difference. The 3 degrees of deception will be 3 layers through which some things have a thicker cover over their godly spark. Some things have a thinner layer over their godly spark, and some have zero to no cover over their godly spark. And I want to talk about these 3 things, starting with a source from 3 degrees of deception from Yechezkel. Ezekiel was a prophet as well. We call him a prophet, the son of a prophet. And he called himself, the Talmud writes about him, that he had a special, more special abilities than other prophets because of that heritage that he had. And he has what's something called the Merkavat Yechezkel, the chariot that Yechezkel experienced. It was one prophecy and one, meditation that he had. And he experienced a lot of these mystical back ends of the universe, which he describes. Some of it is cryptic. Some of it we can understand. Here is one of the verses coming from Yechezkel's vision. It's a very interesting verse. Chapter 1, verse 2. He says, I looked, and behold, a stormy wind came sweeping out of the north, a huge cloud and flashing fire surrounded by a translucent radiance, and in the center of the fire, gleam as of amber. We don't really know what he's talking about, but what we do have here is there's four things. There is a stormy wind, which the translation stormy wind is not so accurate, because se'ara in Hebrew, my Israeli brothers, se'ara, how do you translate? Se'ara is a hurricane, tornado, se'ara. Like a hurricane or tornado. Right here with a samach. Se'ara, like a hurricane or tornado, a very strong wind. Many times when there's a wind like that, you can't see through it. Right? You see the eye of the tornado it's so thick that we can't really see through the wind of the tornado. Not only because it sucked things up inside it, but the wind somehow turns into like a cloud that becomes dark and we can't really see through it. That's one layer of deception. Anan gadol, a big cloud. So we have a big cloud. Eish mislakachas, and a fiery, what would we call it? A flashing fire. Flashing fire is another thing that we can't see through. Fire is one of the most interesting things, as we all know. Everybody is obsessed with fire. There are 3 things that a person can watch for hours. Water, fire, and people working. So what happens when you're watching a fireman put out a fire? God protect us. Anyway, these are the 3 things that people can watch for a very long time. But we can see past fire, which is interesting because fire doesn't really have physical dimensions or components. It's something, it's not something. The mystics love fire because it's one of these things that you can't really touch, but you can see. It's amazing. But you can't see past it. You can't see through a fire. So that's another deceiver. It's another cover where you can't see past it, right? That's kind of the gist that we're getting over here in deception is something that's putting up a screen that you can't see past the screen. However, here comes number 4. And that is noga lo saviv. Noga means light. That's the literal translation of Noga. Noga also, today I think is translated as Mars. Isn't Mars Noga? Noga I think is Mars, but maybe because it's light or it has a different color than the other stars that we see at night, it's the red, but in any event, so it has a Noga is light, lo saviv, there's light around it. Now, if there's light around it, what type of light? Usually you could see right through light. So it's a cover, but it's not a cover. It's a cover that you could see through. This, the mystics write, is four layers of deception. Three are one category. One is another category, and we still didn't do the third layer. So the three are of one category is deception that you can't see through. Now, there are specifics within that, if it's deception of wind, if it's deception of fire, or if it's deception of cloud, and that's an entire subject on its own, which we're not going to discuss tonight. Deception number two is the translucent deception. And what's not in this verse is mitocha, inside it, ke'ena chashmal, inside a chashmal, is interesting. One of the interesting things about this verse is chashmal is a word that has been adapted in modern Hebrew as electricity. Now, Ezekiel, to the best of my knowledge, did not yet publicly announce the discovery of electricity, even if we may think that he may have known about it. So chashmal that he's talking about is not electricity. He translates it here as a gleam of amber, some type of bright something. So inside all of this is that bright something. That bright something is the spirit. That's the godly spirit inside, which has these deceptions on the outside. Either the deception translucent or the deception which is much thicker. But there is a third level that is not really a deception. That's a third level, that there are holy things in this world. There are times that we do see certain revelations. There are certain things that do become revealed in this world as much more open and less removed, so to speak. Less removed will mean that it's doesn't have those covers. It doesn't have that deception. It's holiness that is not removed. It's holiness that's close. It's holiness that's not deceiving us. And this is going to be our three degrees of deception. Complete deception, translucent deception, and holiness. Are you seeing where we're going yet? In physics, there's going to be three things that we can pick up any item and we can ask. Is this item completely deceiving its godly spark? Is this item semi-deceiving? Is this item a vehicle for God? So now, let's go just through small stuff. Pick up a cute hamster who's in the swine family. Pick it up and say, is this a deceiver of God? That's very cute. Makes nice runs in the hamster wheel, but we don't eat it. We don't make a blessing on it. We don't eat it. That would indicate that it's in the strong deceiver category, because we can't bring it to us closer than we might want to. Take the middle level. We can see something. Take a book. Take earbuds. Take a phone. Whatever you might find around you, is that deceiving God? That's neutral. You can use it either to be a tool for doing amazing things as we're doing right here, or could God protect us? It could do the most terrible things in the world. So it's neutral. It's not openly deceiving God. It could deceive, it could not deceive. It will depend on the user, what happens with it. That's a center zone. That's the zone where there's light around it, there's something around it, but it's not an obvious deceiver. Finally, the third layer is going to be the layer of holiness. When somebody sees a Torah, there's no denying that that's a Jewish object. Somebody sees tefillin, somebody sees tzitzit, or what we all pray for a couple times a day is the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. And this brings us right into the third part of this discussion, and that is that there will be three or more places in physics where we will encounter holiness, where we will encounter spaces where there is no deception on God. But before we go to that, is there any questions so far? Yes.
I'd like to go back home.
Yes. Please. So what you're saying is that radio waves, for example, serves a purpose by being hidden. Yes? God also believes that him hiding himself serves a purpose. Because if he was out in the open, if everybody would know that everything is godly, there would be no challenge. There would be no duality, as mentioned before. There would be no struggle. He doesn't want that. He wants there to be this positive deception. And that's why I say what we started earlier, the word deception is very, it rings negative in our heads. But here, this deception is serving a purpose. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody should go home saying, well, I have a deception that's going to serve a purpose. No. We got to be very careful how we apply this rule of using deception as serving a purpose. But as you're saying very good, that most things that are hidden do serve a purpose. And this deception serves a purpose as well. There was a rabbi, just a second to close this up, that said, you know, God, you put all the temptations in front of us and you put the spirit in the books. I have a good idea. Why don't you put the spirit in front of us and put the temptations in the book? But that wouldn't serve the purpose of this deception. Yes, it does. It does. Very good.
Also,
it does. It does. They all link together. Let me do 60 seconds on this. I'm trying to keep each lesson separate, but that's not fair to those that want to keep it together, right? So we'll do 60 seconds on connecting the three lessons. We had lesson one that talked about the world of action, the world of formation, and the world of creation. Asiya, Yetzira, and Bria. We had in lesson two, we talked about 3 degrees of a person's abilities. The intellect, the first 3, the emotions, the next 3, and implementing that in action, the final 3, loosely. And these all reflect each other. Because when we are in action, in the world of action, how far removed are we from our inner core? We've jumped 3 stages. We jumped the stage of our intellect, we jumped the stage of our emotion, and now we're in the world of action. We have moved along from our core selves quite a bit. In the 3 worlds, it's the same thing. We're the bottom. The world of Bria is much closer to having clarity. The angels there, they see God's spirit. They go to Yetzira, they still see God's spirit, though a little bit more modified. Now they're seeing more the Noga, the light version. When it comes to us, we see thick clouds. Very well said. That's the crisscross. Oh, these 3 crisscross. And tonight is lesson 3. How amazing is all these 3s? Yes. Yes. Once they come out, we don't see that process anymore. Once we see a, let's call it for argument's sake, an unkosher animal, we don't see that it went through all those stages of removement, so to speak, for that spark to be concealed. But let's go through a few parts here because it's gonna still tie together. The next piece here, which he talks about in the book, is gonna be 3 places where holiness could be seen, or where holiness is expected to be seeked, right? We're not saying to seek holiness in the places where it was intentionally covered. The places where holiness was covered, we're not meant to seek that. There is holiness there, but right now it's not on us to seek it. Somebody will say, as a man who made a lot of trouble in the Jewish world, known as Shabtai Tzvi, who said, I want to make even the part that is completely removed from God, I don't want to make that holy. And he would go and do, unfortunately, things that cost us a lot, especially during that generation, terrible things. And he was saying that what he's doing is he's engaging the furthest level of deception in order to bring that into holiness. But that's not our work right now. What our work now during our lifetime is to engage the translucent. That middle zone is our part. And it's, you know, it takes wisdom, it takes study to know what is what. But we're going to get to that in a few minutes. Let's continue here with places in the world of holiness. There's place that has holy, that is removed, so to speak, that has, now the removed is going to flip a little bit because those are places that's removed from, let's say, physics, from the coarse physics, but it's much more open and much more available to God's presence. There's place, there is time, and people. So there's going to be places in the world that are uniquely holy. There are going to be times in our calendar that are uniquely holy. There are going to be people that have been placed on this earth that are uniquely holy. Let's talk about all three. Again, these are all very broad subjects, but let's run through them quickly because they're important. Places that are holy. What can we think of places that are holy besides the Holy Temple in Jerusalem? Synagogues, very good. What else? Some springs that brings out it's a special spot. I'll tell you something about springs just because you mentioned it. Springs have a very unique Jewish application for mikvah, for purity purposes. Springs can never become impure, which says something very deep about a spring. And we find that people are obsessed with springs. So what you're saying is very true. In Israel, there's a lot of hunts to go find springs. And it's amazing because there's so many there, more than other places. I think you're asking a great question. And perhaps what you're describing is the middle zone that could go either way, because there are places on this earth that are very, very unholy. Let's go to the extreme and call it a gas chamber. There is no architect of a gas chamber that is thinking about a divine plan. God is hidden from there. God is separated very, very far from there. Now, nothing on this earth can exist without a godly spark, but go find God there. I don't attempt to do that. And any rabbi that does, I'm not on that team. God there, that's a very dark place. So that's a space that we could understand that there's unholy spaces, meaning places that God has been chased away from, so to speak, even though that's not possible. Correct. That's the absurdity about this deception. I tripped myself going the extreme because now all these questions exploded in everybody's head, and I know. So, but it's okay. Questions are fine. How did we say in lesson one? Battling with the divine might turn you into a prophet, because the best that we've ever had have done that. So that's also possible. That's okay. For some, but trouble for another. That's possible. Holiness could be something, and I think that's very well said. You're saying that holiness could be something that is subjective. And that's possible. That's what we're saying. Oh, very good. That wasn't mentioned. A grave of a tzaddik, a kever of a righteous person. We believe those places to be spaces within planet Earth that have been designated as uniquely holy. They're not anymore in the middle zone. They earned a special space in being on the holy side. Yes. Very good. Very good. This is where these discussions are very broad. And they are broad and they open up. We could spend a long time on each one of these. And not to leave it undone, is this is exactly what God intended. He could have made holy places naturally, but he didn't do that. He made holy places through man making them holy. And that's one of the most inspirational ideas that this concept brings out, that we're partners in all of this. Because as we're going to go through the other three, we will discover that they are man-made. One second, not only that, but the God-made places are not holy anymore, like Sinai. Let's go on. How did you know? That's the next one. That's the next one where we go into time. That is, I would tie that with the subjective part and the more objective part. The general. Right. Let's regroup here a second. About Shabbat again, a quick parenthesis about Shabbat. If a person is in the desert, which is an actual case in the Talmud, a person is in the desert, he doesn't know what day of the week it is. What does he do? When does he celebrate Shabbat? Does he do it every day? Well, he's got to make a living in the desert. He starts counting. One opinion says he celebrates Shabbat right now and then count 7 days to the next Shabbat. Another one says start seven from now, 7 weekdays, and then you go to the seven. Either way, both opinions agree that there's an element of Shabbat that's man-made. Because you could fulfill Shabbat even if you don't know what day of the week it is. Now, the holidays, which we're coming to Pesach, some people will say, oh, I'm not able to eat the matzah on Pesach. I want to eat the matzah today. That doesn't do the mitzvah. Notwithstanding, the holidays in times of old were established by people seeing the moon and announcing that they saw the moon, meaning, and then the holidays would be established based on when Rosh Chodesh was called from their witnessing of seeing the new moon. That means that the holidays were man-made as well. If the date was a day later, just because it was cloudy the night before and nobody saw it, it is what it is. And all the spiritual energies that the holiday encompasses would be pushed off a day, because there is a relationship here. There is a communication between the uppers and the lowers. And this kind of ties together a lot of what we're discussing here. The spirit here is always in communication with the spirit. Not even going to say on high, because that's incorrect. The spirit within is always in communication with the spirit within. There is something that's always happening, and we're part of that. We're part of that communication. Finally, we talk about, I feel like this is an easy one. Does everybody know who this is? Very good. The Rambam. Now, this is the picture that's more well known, but that's a couple hundred year old statue in Spain where the Rambam lived. It resembles each other, but we don't know which one it was. Somebody once came to a great rabbi and said that Avram Avinu came to me in a dream. And it's funny that here the rabbi was the cynic. And the rabbi said, how do you know how Avram Avinu looked? All right, take it or leave it. So this is this holy people. I want to spend a minute on holy people. But before that, let's go through a couple of slides here from the actual text of the book. Page 53. We'll go through place, time, and people. The sanctity of place is objective, a thing in its own right. But in order to be conscious of the sanctity, one has to be... Anybody know that word? Yeah? Yeah, me? Okay, at least I'm not the only one that didn't know that word. I was like, I never saw that word before. I Googled it, participate in a certain experience. For it is seldom that holiness is made extremely evident in the material world. That's very powerful. So holiness is not out in the open here. We kind of got to seek it. But where we seek it is important. Here we go to the tombs of saints and giants, for instance, or the places where they performed memorable deeds may acquire great spiritual value. But such sites are not of the same order and are not to be confused with that true connection between God and place which has been revealed in the radiating sanctity of the Holy Temple. That was a place that was by far more experienced than anybody that ever came there. And again, these are very large discussions, but the temple has become the symbol of holy places within the world in terms of place. Let's go to time. It's in this way that holy days, this is from page 58, it's in this way that holy days are connected to significant historic happenings, such as the Exodus from Egypt or Passover, the receiving of the Torah on Mount Sinai, on Shavuot, or the wanderings of the children of Israel in the wilderness that is celebrated on Sukkot. These holy festivals are not intended simply as memorial days to keep alive their memory of the events. They are divinely appointed times dedicated to a renewal of the same revelation that once occurred on that day, in that year, repetition and a restoration of the same forces. This is very important. This is something that has become much more appreciated in modern times. Not because of technology, it just became more dispersed, this idea that, let's say, Pesach is a holiday of freedom. Ask almost anybody, what do we celebrate? I'll tell you, freedom. It became almost like inborn, or Hanukkah, we celebrate light. And we deeply believe that these are moments, that these themes were introduced to us as a growing nation back in the day, and they are reborn and re-inspired and reinvigorated every year, stronger and stronger from year to year. So Passover, we have the opportunities to become freer, and there's energy in the air that of freedom that is accessible during these holidays. So that the sanctity of these holidays is derived not only from a primal divine revelation, but also from Israel's continual re-sanctification and the way that it keeps these days holy of this revelation. Finally, this is a long one, but it's the tzaddik, it's the person, and I feel that it's important to spend a minute on, first of all, because today we're living in a time where they're becoming increasingly harder to find. It's harder and harder to find a tzaddik. We read about righteous people. We've heard about righteous people. They're just becoming harder to come by. So if anybody wants to volunteer, that'd be fantastic. In the meantime, let's read what it says here on page 62. The life of a holy person becomes an example and a model for all men to follow. That's the purpose of holy people. They were placed here to inspire others. And a holy person may be a great king or a saintly tzaddik, a sage, or a leader of his age, but he may also be one of the saintly hidden, one of the hidden saints whose holiness goes unrecognized by men. But in whatever manner their holiness shows itself, and no matter how intrinsic it may be to the personality of the man or person, it is still dependent on his connection with the divine. The ordinary man has been granted contact with the holy person, is thereby brought into a certain contact with true holiness. In this sense, the higher the level of a saintly person's holiness, the more he is like an angel, and in a way even more than an angel. This is an important parenthesis. Acting as a vehicle of holiness by transmitting divine energy from one world to another and bestowing such energy upon whomever he chooses. Through his blessings, his actions, his prayers, doesn't say it here, but his study as well. The individual who makes inner contact with such a holy person, showing him love and devotion, thereby supports the flow of divine energy in this world. This is what is meant in Jewish tradition from time immemorial, when devotion has been shown to those persons who are superior in holiness or have an aura of sanctity. The gift is given such blessed men to create or people such a bond of some sort that will draw them nearer, whether the holy person is connected to God by being a great scholar of the Torah or whether he is just a saintly individual in their life. To honor, revere, and love the holy person is a mitzvah in itself, one of the 613 commandments, besides serving as a means for direct contact with holiness. In other words, the summary of these three zones in place, time, or people are almost as if to say that there are these portals to access unfiltered holiness, unfiltered godliness, the unfiltered spirit. So now let's go back to our original questions. Is bacon holy? There is a spark in there. Is time holy? Sometimes can be very holy. Is space holy? Are people holy? Are animals holy? And what is holy? Now we understand a little bit what is holy. I want to say, though, that time, as you mentioned, could be subjective holiness. When we take time and find the divine spark in that time, by doing the right thing with our time, by spending time with our children at that time, by studying Torah with that time, we are elevating that time for all of eternity because that time never returns. So that time becomes stored in wherever it gets stored, in some hard drive warehouse somewhere, that time has been clocked in as being revealed godly time. And the same thing with space, the same thing with people. I want to conclude with a question that I think is relevant to some. Are pets holy? And in my picture, I have, I believe, non-kosher animals. Yes? I believe so. The rabbit chews its cud, but it doesn't have split hooves or the opposite. It has, the hair is mentioned specifically as being non-kosher. In any event, are pets holy? What do you say? Yet. I want to put a little parenthesis here. We'll get technical for a quick minute. We're going to go to the side of what we called originally the dark clouds, where we don't see open holiness clearly. There are two rules when it comes to things that are not the middle zone. The middle zone are things that we can eat, things that are kosher, things that we can eat, things that we can connect to in any way. On the dark side, there are some things that we can eat. I'm sorry, there's nothing on the dark side that we can eat. The dark side typically are things that we're supposed to stay away from completely. But the dark side is divided into two levels, two degrees. One degree, you're not allowed to eat, but you are allowed to enjoy. One degree is you're not allowed to eat and you're not allowed to enjoy. an example of enjoying is making money off. Benefiting is the correct word. Benefiting from it. Are we allowed to benefit from it? In Jewish law, there are two things. For things that we don't engage in, there is that it's forbidden to eat, and then there is it's forbidden to benefit from. An example of things that are forbidden to benefit from is chametz on Pesach. Chametz on Pesach is forbidden to eat and forbidden to benefit from. Kosher food. I'm sorry. Non-kosher food. Is it permitted to eat? No. Is it permitted to benefit from? It depends which. Are you allowed to sell? Are you allowed to own stock in McDonald's? Are you allowed? So hold on. It depends. In non-kosher foods, there's two categories. One category, you are allowed to benefit, but you're not allowed to eat. One category, you're not allowed to eat, you're not allowed to benefit. And just for fun, the part that you're not allowed to eat and that you're not allowed to benefit in food is either chametz on Pesach or the first 3 years in Israel of certain fruits, or this is the fun one, kosher meat with kosher milk that's combined. Then it becomes forbidden to have pleasure from. But if it's non-kosher meat with non-kosher milk, you could have benefit from it. If it's only non-kosher meat, you could have benefit from it, a non-kosher product, which would mean animals that are unkosher, that you're not eating, are you allowed to have benefit from them? Yes. Not only that, but a form of, if you're allowed to have benefit from it, then when a human or a Jew or any type of benefit is being derived from that animal, a service, a emotional support animal, a service animal, which is giving support now to somebody, that animal is actually being elevated. Now that animal is serving another purpose. That animal is serving its perhaps divine purpose. So if it's degrees in which benefit is allowed, are pets holy when they serve a higher purpose than themselves, which many times is us? Of course. And that's something incredible. We do believe in paradise for because paradise is that spiritual space where things that move to the side of holiness connect to. So then automatically, any type of being or existence that has been engaged in a purposeful engagement has now a place for eternity in a spiritual spot. Yes, I agree. I want to conclude with one story, after which we'll open to questions. The story goes like this. It's a mystical Baal Shem Tov story. It's a fun story. The rule of the Baal Shem Tov stories is if you believe in all the stories, you're a fool. If you believe that the stories could not have happened, you're a heretic. So what's beautiful about the Baal Shem Tov stories, you can kind of pick and choose which ones you want to believe happened, which ones didn't happen. The idea of a lot of these stories are more of lessons and to get an idea of many of them are mystical, you know, lessons that are brought through the form of story. So here goes the story. The Baal Shem Tov was in a town, as he did. He traveled from town to town and he comes to this particular town. And one of the people in the town, a woman, heard that he was there and told her husband, there's a great tzaddik in town. I would love if you would go see him. And he says, what are you talking about? I don't believe in this stuff. I'm good the way I am. I study Torah. I'm a scholar. I don't need this in my life. This is a new branch of Judaism, these mystics. I'm not interested. She says, what do you care? I won't tell anybody. I won't tell your friends. He's here for a day or two. Go see him. Nothing will happen. So for you, I'll do it. He goes and sees the Baal Shem Tov. And the Baal Shem Tov takes a quick look at him and starts engaging him in conversation and says, is there anything you need in your life? Anything you want? Did you come here for a blessing? And he says, nope. I came here because my wife told me to come here. There's nothing in my life that I lack. God blessed me with a couple of dollars. God blessed me with a beautiful wife. God blessed me with amazing children. God blessed me with a brilliant mind. I'm a scholar. I had everything I want. I don't need anything in the world. I don't need your blessings. So the Baal Shem Tov says, fine. Can I offer you a story? Would you take a story? I'm always in for a story. I'll listen to a story. He says, let me tell you a story. Years ago, there was a man who was a great man, lacked nothing in his life. He did everything well. Everything was proper. Everything was okay. The only thing was that he wasn't careful when he would eat or drink. He wasn't careful to make a blessing before eating or drinking. There are blessings that we make. He wasn't careful with making the blessings. So when he came up on high, they have the famous court case that we all talk about of the end of times, and they're going through his life. What did he do? And amazing accomplishments here, amazing accomplishments there. But there's one place where it wasn't so great. His blessings weren't his strong part. What do? We're going to send his soul back down here. We're going to send his soul back down to planet Earth, and it's going to have to go through another series of life in order to be more careful with blessings. And sure enough, the soul comes down here, but it doesn't come down in the form of a human. It comes down in the form of a grain of wheat. And there is a soul now trapped in a grain of wheat that is waiting for redemption. And how will it get redeemed? It needs somebody to get that grain of wheat somewhere, somehow, and make a blessing on it before it eats it. And as soon as that grain will be ingested, after a blessing, that grain of wheat will be elevated. And sure enough, the grain of wheat is making its way through the factory. First, the soul inside the grain grows and is hoping after 6 months it's growing, from hoping that it gets cut and that it doesn't fall on the wayside. And he sees that when it comes cutting day, his buddy got thrown to the wayside. He says, "Oh, no, don't throw me to the wayside. I'm going to have to come back again." And sure enough, it gets cut and it gets into the mill. Fine, it gets into the mill. I don't know if it was wheat or barley. It turns into a liquid. It gets into the mill, and it's hoping it gets into the vat. I hope I don't fall over. And as it's going along, there's all these details of the story that the Baal Shem Tov is telling this fine young gentleman. Finally, at the end, this grain ends up in a bottle of liquor. This soul ends up in a bottle of liquor. And he's like, "Heaven protect me. What's going to happen now? I'm stuck now in a bottle of liquor. What are my chances?" And sure enough, the liquor goes through the shop, and the person comes, the person goes. Finally, the liquor gets purchased by what they had then, these inns, and the liquor is in the inn. And all he can hope for is that a Jew will come to that liquor, to that inn, and somehow, anyway, the bottle is going down, and somehow the soul doesn't slip out of the bottle. It keeps getting poured. It's still stuck in the bottle. And one day, the day comes that soul jumps out of the bottle, and it's now in a little achayim cup. It's in a little glass, waiting and praying that the person holding the glass will make that blessing. But the person holding the glass was with a few Gentile friends and didn't have the courage to make the blessing, and took that cup and drank the cup. And the soul inside now has to come back for another round. The man sitting in the room goes pale, and he says, "Baal Shem Tov, what can I do? I was that man. I remember the story. This was a few weeks ago. I was there. I didn't make a blessing. I was embarrassed. I didn't want to make a scene. I didn't make the blessing." The Baal Shem Tov tells him, "That soul was the soul of your father. And this whole world went around, finally got you to that moment. And at that moment, where were you to be there for your dad? And he was a broken man." Now his wife said, "This is what I needed." His wife sends him to Baal Shem Tov, and he says, "Baal Shem Tov, tell me, you got to help me. You know, you told me this information. Now help me repair it." And the Baal Shem Tov went on to tell him exactly what to do to repair it, to find his father's soul elsewhere and elevate it. And the story goes, the record goes dark. Hopefully everything was done. The students of the Baal Shem Tov turned to him and said, "What's going on here?" And the Baal Shem Tov said, "I came to this town because I was called on high from this soul, that this soul went through such a long journey. How much are we going to torture this soul? And I just needed this interaction with this guy. I didn't know who the guy was. So thank God his wife said that. As soon as this emerged, I realized this must be the guy. And I figured it out and I closed up the story." The purpose of the story wraps up tonight's lesson, that there is sparks all over the place, and we have possibilities wherever we are to bring things into the realm of into the realm of holiness. Chag Sameach. Questions? Absolutely. Absolutely. It's all the same. It's all the same category. That's what we started with tonight as well. The honor, the importance of recognizing that those that they're on our team, they're on our team. We should be as good as them sometimes. Yes. Most. So it's a good question. What you're asking is, are all things holy, man-made? Right. Most of it, as we, the words that we'll use is initiated by us and then expanded through the divine light. That would be the terms. That would be the correct terms. And there's a Talmudic passage that would allude to that. Piskuli kechude shalmachat, it says, open your hearts, even a pin needle, even a pinhole. And I will expand it the size of the hechel, which was a very large door. It's an indication of something very large. So there is a very strong, you see, a very strong undercurrent here that the idea is that it should be initiated by us, that most of holiness in this world will be initiated by us, but it needs a response. Yes. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So we didn't need a verse. We just needed a linguist. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. Interesting. Yes, in Torah, the word Kedesha. Kedesha. Yes. The extremes are there in one word. You see what he was doing in yeshiva. jokes. It's only because I know Michael, so I can say them. The bracha changes. Very nice. That's a good illustration. Yes, good. Most things, we're talking a lot about nature and these things. Most things in nature are not ideal for humans raw. They need a process. They need to be cooked. They need to be mixed with other ingredients. And that's another place where we see that human animals, they just eat whatever they eat. They don't, no chefs. I don't think so. We haven't found that one yet. Wishing you all a great Pesach. All the best.
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcasts site or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about Temple Beth Am Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.